Hello, on this week's programme, Jason Pfeiffer explores the process of developing new plays at the 4th Annual Playpen Conference in Philadelphia. Susan Lewis looks at the all-female choreographers project of Philadelphia's Ballet X. The contemporary programme features three new works. We listen back to an interview with author Mari Yoshihara. Her book, Musicians from a Different Shore, explores how Asian cultures came to embrace Western music. And Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns reports on centennial celebrations of the great auditorium pipe organ at Ocean Grove on the Jersey Shore. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Playpen, the development conference for new plays, is back in Philadelphia for its fourth year. The program annually selects a handful of playwrights from across the country and brings them to the city in July to continue developing their works in progress. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, for both fledgling and veteran writers, the conference is designed to be a laboratory for playwrights where, with the help of a team, they are free to experiment and even fail.
Playpen's founder and artistic director Paul Meshedjian says it's been a tough year for theater funding. He attributes the downturn to the struggling economy and to the upcoming elections. He believes many traditional donors are supporting political causes this year. Meshedjian explains this 2008 trend continues an ongoing trend.
There's less and less money available for the development of new work.
Because of the scarcity of support, Meshedjian says playwrights too often don't have the opportunity to tweak and refine their scripts before trying to market the work to theater companies. This is where Playpen tries to make a difference. The two-week conference provides six playwrights with a full range of resources. Living expenses are covered, a director of the writer's choice is provided, and a dramaturg offers a helping hand, assisting with research, firming up the play's dramatic structure, and at times offering constructive criticism. Longtime dramaturg and Playpen board member Michelle Volansky says the role of the dramaturg looks different with each playwright involved.
I take my cue from the playwright, and I really try to respond to what their needs are at any given moment. Sometimes it involves walking half a block to the gelato place. Sometimes it involves tearing apart the play and putting it back together.
Along with the dramaturgical help, Playpen also supplies 29 hours of rehearsal time for each play with a group of actors. Bruce Graham, a Philadelphia-based playwright and screenwriter for over 25 years, notes that playwrights benefit by listening closely to input from actors as a new script is brought to life in rehearsal.
I found that if a smart actor has a problem with the line, there's usually a problem with the line.
Like many forms of writing, crafting a play usually involves hours and hours of solitary work. But unlike other writing, like a novel, a play is brought to life on stage by others. So there comes a time for playwrights when they need to come out from behind the writing desk and see how well the play works with these others involved. Peter Bonilla's first play, A Human Equation, is part of this year's conference. His work at Playpen includes rehearsal sessions with a group of 12 people, including Oscar nominee actor David Strathairn.
I will hold... we're going to have something
there. Yeah, we'll have something there. Sorry, I'll figure it out, but just keep going.
I will hold 931...
Peter Bonilla says the chance to work in a rehearsal room with actors, a director, and a dramaturg is the necessary next step in his play's development process.
I've gotten kind of to the point where nothing in it really surprises me anymore.
Bonilla, a former literary manager and dramaturg for the Interact Theater Company in Philadelphia, says in his observation, the more talented people are gathered to work on a play,
the more the ideas are going to proliferate and the more things are going to start jumping out, really just starting to kind of kickstart my brain process again.
During its first 4 years, Playpen largely catered to less experienced, younger writers like Peter Bonilla. For playwrights at this stage in their career, 2 weeks of intensive help can be invaluable. For seasoned, experienced playwrights, however, Playpen's artistic director Paul Meshedjian says 2 weeks of group work on a new play often isn't necessary.
Because what they need at this point in their writing careers can be gotten in 1 or 2 days of work as opposed to what the younger writer might need.
In addition to this year's conference is the staged readings of two new plays from veteran writers Jeffrey Hatcher and Bruce Graham. They won't be participating in a full 2 weeks of development, but they will get the opportunity to hear their pieces in front of an audience. Graham, whose play Any Given Monday was presented last evening, says on these sort of occasions, he's not paying much attention to those on stage.
it's actors in chairs with scripts, and I know what the actors look like. I'll be standing to the side here watching the audience, and the first person who wriggles in their chair, or looks at their watch, or coughs, or reads their program, I'm saying something wrong with the play. And then sometimes you just realize that person's an idiot, you know. But if seven or eight in one row start to do it, then you say, okay, you start paying attention.
Graham says regardless of whether or not a playwright is new or very experienced, it's incredibly helpful to have a safe, low-pressure environment, like Playpen, where a playwright has the freedom to try out new ideas with actors, a director, and maybe an audience.
George Burns once mourned the death of vaudeville by saying, comics now have no place to go and be bad. We've got to make our mistakes in public. And when you make them in public with a full-scale, fully funded, costumes, lights, sets production, chances are it's not going to get a second production. This process allows you to go out and take some chances and fall on your face sometimes.
Having the liberty to make mistakes and learn from them is a vital part of the conference, according to Paul Meshejian. He says Playpen is not about fixing new plays. Rather, it's about allowing playwrights to figure out for themselves how to develop their work without being concerned about trying to please a producer or a theater company.
We try to make sure that commerce is not at the door, and there's going to be plenty of time for the market to do its work on the play and for the playwright to be asked to please change the end or get rid of this character or add a character, whatever it may be. But if we can allow the writer during their time here to develop the play on its own terms, there's an opportunity for the play to have its integrity when it leaves here.
It's difficult to predict what the state of today's economy means for Playpen's newest batch of works. When money is tight, theaters become more risk-averse and often avoid new plays. But Playpen's track record should provide some hope for its writers. Paul Meshejian says so far, 60% of the plays that have been developed in past conferences have gone on to full productions.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Playpen culminates this week at the Adrian Theatre in Philadelphia with free stage readings of new plays through July 27th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Philadelphia's Ballet X is a contemporary ballet company committed to interpreting the classical form in 21st century terms. Its newest venture is a program devoted to all female choreographers. A surprisingly novel concept in a dance world where the majority of dancers are women, but most high-profile choreographers are still men. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us behind the scenes to Ballet X's all-female choreography project, presenting three world premieres.
Apples, the kind that grow on trees, dancing across a stage, are not traditional ballet fare.
It's thrown in the air, it's rolling on the floor, it's in the mouth, in the hands, on the heads.
Annabelle Lopez Ochoa works out in rehearsal the way she wants to use the apple in her new ballet, Still Life.
I chose the apple because it has different connotation. It is a piece of fruit that you see very often on still lives, and it is also a biblical fruit that is used at the beginning of the Genesis, why it all started between Eve and Adam.
Playing with tradition, while not abandoning it, happens a lot in Ballet X. In co-founding the company, former Pennsylvania ballet dancers Matthew Neenan and Christine Cox wanted to do something with the traditional form that was edgier, sexier. Cox says the idea of the program of all-female choreographers arose out of their experiences choosing works for this new dance company.
When you're a director and you're looking for choreographers to choose from, and 9 out of 10 are men, and you'll have one woman, and well, why is that? We were curious.
Is the scarcity of well-known women choreographers because they don't exist, or because women haven't risen to a certain level of visibility within the art form?
It might be both, I think, and that's one of the reasons we're doing this project. If you look across the board in general, even on Broadway, and there are more men choreographing than there are women in America. But what fascinates me is if you go into a dance studio, 85% are females.
Coming from Europe, we don't really have that issue because there's a lot of female choreographers, though there are not lots of female choreographers in classical companies.
Choreographer Annabelle Lopez Ochoa is based in the Netherlands.
It has always been ruled by men creating dance for women, and women being the muse, so being at the service of the ideas of a man.
Lopez Ochoa has since 2003 created dance for European ballet companies. She also works in theater. A classically trained dancer, she moved into modern dance and then joined the Scapino Ballet in Rotterdam, where she was a soloist for 7 years. But the idea of choreography had tugged at her since she was an 11-year-old ballet student.
Right before the Christmas break, our teacher said, "Today I'm going to give you 1 minute of music. I'll be leaving the room for 1 hour, and you just find a friend and make something." And I didn't understand what I had to make, but it was the best hour of that whole year. And I decided then, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. This is the best of dancing, is creating movements on music in space with your friends.
In contrast, Christine Cox, a 2008 recipient of the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts Award for Choreography, had not envisioned herself as a choreographer until the year 2000, when Pennsylvania Ballet was preparing its annual AIDS benefit, Shut Up and Dance.
I thought, well, why not? I love to create dances in my mind and movement. But I was so scared. It was so different than dancing. It was like someone saw inside of me when I choreographed. And I felt far more vulnerable choreographing than I ever did dancing. So then I knew I had to continue. Because if it made me that nervous, there was something there to discover.
The third choreographer on the program is Helen Pickett, who trained at the San Francisco Ballet School and was a principal dancer with Ballet Frankfurt before she turned to choreography in 2005 with a work for the Boston Ballet. Three choreographers, each creating an original work. Dancer Tara Keating is in all three.
One of the nice things about having a piece created on you is you get to interact with the choreographer. So she may show something that she wants, you try it and you do it a little different. She said, "Oh, you know what? I like that. Keep that."
From Keating's perspective, each choreographer is distinctive.
Definitely, each person has a different vibe, so you kind of have to get into that mood before rehearsal, knowing, okay, I'm going in with Helen, and this is what she wants, and okay, now I'm with Christine, and she may want something different. The third piece by Annabelle Lopez Ochoa, we're all dancing with apples.
The apples are just one part of Lopez Ochoa's still life. She describes her style as a cocktail of jazz and classical ballet.
It's covering a lot of space. It's using isolations of the body, so I'm using also just the head movements or just the shoulder movement or just the hips movement, but always in a classical line.
Still life is inspired in part by Lopez Ochoa's dislike of still life paintings and in part by her fascination with the works of painters like Michelangelo.
There's always a lot of people and a lot of pain, a lot of joy. And I was always wondering what happened before that frozen moment or what happens right after that frozen moment.
The dance is set to the music of Bach, the Dutch composer Wassenaar, and even periods of silence accented by human utterances and dropping apples. In contrast, the songs of the British band Portishead infuse Christine Cox's Numb Roads, a dance about relationships and being single, expressing both the passion and the numbness that can occur in each.
I think the pivotal moment is when the younger, vibrant couple comes out, because what they represent is what everybody sort of wants. That euphoric feeling that happens when you're falling in love is unlike anything in life. And you find it, and then it changes. And then that's when the relationship really starts to grow and enhance. And in the lyrics it says, "Nobody loves me like you do." And I just love that.
The third work, Helen Pickett's Union, is set to an original score by Bernd Sippel. Three styles of music, three dances, three choreographers, all female. Does gender matter? It may matter in getting work in a traditional field, even now. But is the program distinctively feminine?
Just from watching the two other women work, they're both very different, and they both approach their work in their own unique way. It's very difficult steps and challenging physicality and mentally challenging, and I don't think you would leave the show thinking, boy, that's a lot of girly things.
Gender is undoubtedly one ingredient in the batch of life experiences that gives rise to artistic perspective and expression. and audience members will reach their own conclusions as to how much it flavors the mix. But in the end, each individual choreographer, male or female, has something unique to say, driven perhaps by a common passion for the dance, for the leaping through space, claiming it, reaching out to discover and share a sense of wordless joy.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Ballet X's all-female choreography project opens Wednesday evening and runs through Sunday afternoon. All choreographers will participate in a Q&A session after Wednesday's show. On Thursday afternoon at 4, a free panel discussion will explore the roles of female choreographers in ballet. All events are at the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia. Musicians from and of Asian descent are ubiquitous in the world of Western classical music. A significant presence in music schools, professional ensembles, and as concert soloists. How Eastern culture came to embrace Western music is the subject of a new book, Musicians from a Different Shore. Its author, Mari Yoshihari, is now an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii, but began studying piano in her native Japan at the age of 3, a practice common among middle-class households in the last part of the 20th century. In her book, Yoshihari combines historical research with personal interviews of contemporary Asian and Asian American musicians to present both a comprehensive study of the intersection of culture, race, and music, and an intimate glance into the human stories behind the trends. It's obvious to anybody who goes to classical music concerts or who buys classical music recordings these days that there is a huge amount of Asian and Asian American musicians. Tell us the history of how we've got to this situation.
Well, this is, depending on how you see it, you can see it as a recent phenomenon or a more historical phenomenon. I would say that the noticeable increase in the number of Asians and Asian Americans in classical music, maybe about the last 2 or 3 decades. But there is a long history that led up to it, from the introduction of Western music to Japan, China, and Korea from the late 19th and early 20th century. And, those three nations made very programmatic efforts to make it a very central part of their culture, very much led by the government and then also pushed by the middle class, aspiration for middle class. So there's a long history leading up to it. And especially after the end of World War II in Japan and after Korean War in Korea, after the Cultural Revolution in China, it became a very widely middle class phenomenon for the people there to pursue classical music. So that's sort of the historical and social basis for this recent phenomenon.
And this was about looking west and saying what? What were people saying about the West that convinced them that classical music was something that children should learn?
I would say initially, in the early part of the 20th century, it was classical music was associated definitely with Western modernity. And so the aspiration to become bourgeois middle class was kind of the central economic and social pull for agents. But one of the things that I'm trying to say in the book is that it became a lot more than that, especially in the last 2 or 3 decades. I would say that for most Asians in Asia today, classical music is not necessarily seen as something specifically European or even Western. It's a very central part of their own culture. And so they don't necessarily, especially the musicians who are pursuing it, they don't necessarily think of it as something, they're doing something foreign or Western. It's just, part of their lives and their identity.
You're not writing from a totally uninvolved point of view. Mm-hmm. You yourself went through this phenomenon, having your parents encourage you to take up a musical instrument.
More than encourage.
Okay. What word should I use?
Push.
Okay. Your parents pushing you to take up a musical instrument.
Yeah.
The parental influence shouldn't be understated in this because amongst Asians, and I don't want to make a broad sweeping statement, but there would appear to be a greater respect and a greater desire to please one's parents in the mm-hmm. East than there is in the West. Is mm-hmm. that the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a generalization, but I think, there's some truth to, those kinds of generalizations. And I mean, because for people who become professional musicians, they really have to start serious training by age 5 or 7 at the latest. And, most kids don't choose to, do rigorous study of classical music at such an early age. I mean, most people start, because their parents want them to, and then especially in Asia, there's stronger emphasis on kind of regimented training, both in practice and lessons. And so that's very central to the way in which these musicians are trained and disciplined, really.
They say the last century was America's century, and this will be China's or Asia's century. Can you foresee a situation when the U.S. and Europe will not be the meccas to which these musicians are drawn, and that you will have orchestras of significant standing in, for instance, China? You already have in Japan, but more so in China.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, and it's interesting. I mean, the introduction of Western music to Asia is not simply kind of a one-way street from West or, say, Europe to Asia. Like, for instance, a lot of Chinese and Korean musicians in the early 20th century, they went to Japan to study, not Europe or the United States, because it was more feasible economically, geographically, and whatnot. And so even today, like in a lot of Japanese orchestras, there are, you know, musicians from other parts of Asia, you know, working there. And so, you know, I can totally see, like, 10, 20 years from now, like, you know, Shanghai Symphony or, you know, Beijing Orchestra, they would be like real players in the world of classical music worldwide.
Mari Yashihara, Musicians from a Different Shore, is published by Temple University Press. Walking into the great auditorium in Ocean Grove, New Jersey, means entering an era your great-grandparents might have known, if they were beachgoers or Methodist. To your left in this massive structure, designed to seat a 7,000-strong congregation, is a lighted sign that declares, "Holiness to the Lord." To the right, a similar sign adds, "So be ye holy." The ceiling is lined with lights like a Ferris wheel, and a World War I American flag similarly illuminates itself. The focal point, however, is something illuminating the room with music, a pipe organ that's celebrating its 100th birthday this summer with a series of concerts with orchestras and brass ensembles. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered that the organ's history wasn't always glorious, but contains tales of extravagance, neglect, suicide, and, in the name of progress, vandalism.
To understand the Ocean Grove organ is to appreciate the unlikelihood that anything of its size was built here. Ocean Grove was a religious camp by the sea. Some of the structures were, and still are, temporary house-sized tents. Its towering pipe organ was built in 1908 for the then-steep sum of $27,000. Numbers tell part of the story. While Philadelphia's Kimball Center organ has 125 ranks that total nearly 7,000 pipes, the Ocean Grove instrument, which serves a larger auditorium and a more populous function, has 176 ranks totaling 10,823 pipes. In fact, this town has more organ pipes than it has people. Twice as many, and then some.
It's very unusual.
The organ's curator, John Shaw, has written a centennial booklet titled The Great Auditorium Organ.
To build an immense organ for use only in the summer months, some individuals would say is kind of over the edge. But this building has had a history of a great music program going all the way back to its inception in 1894. Many of the great opera stars around the turn of the century sang here. Schumann and Gallicherchi and McCormick and Caruso all were here in Ocean Grove. And eventually it became apparent that a large organ should be built in order to accommodate congregations which were anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 people.
The organ builder was an innovative Englishman, Robert Hope Jones, who believed in spending whatever was necessary to create a great instrument and trust that the money would show up somehow. In fact, Ocean Grove probably got twice the organ that it could afford. Hope Jones paid for half of it, hoping to give demonstration recitals for prospective investors in his company. One was Andrew Carnegie, who was quoted as saying he wanted an organ to overwhelm me with the feeling of how miserable a sinner I am. It's not that kind of organ. It's imposing. One of the pipes weighs more than a ton. Resident organist Gordon Turk compares some of the organ sounds to an explosion in a lumber factory. But even uncoached ears hear the instrument's most distinctive aspect, a mellow, often ethereal timbre.
A lot of these sounds are from vintage pipes that we sought particular builders, particularly Ernest Skinner built wonderful instruments in America in the teens, 20s, 30s, up into the 40s. And there are several ranks in here that are from that particular builder, the vintage pipes, and then other new ones that we've had built which are in the same, along the same line. This is a Hope Jones sound, one of the original. There you go. It It's a very quiet, and this sound he built to go with it. And then we have all these other sounds, a lot of Skinner pipes to add to it that increase the warmth mm-hmm. and, the mellowness of the organ. And there also are a lot, there's a higher ratio of wooden pipes in this organ than in many instruments, and that gives additional solidity and warmth to it as well. One of my favorites is the clarinet stop.
Over the decades, the instrument wasn't well maintained, and by 1961, when the famous Virgil Fox came to perform, he was appalled and said so from the stage, recalls curator John Shaw.
And I can remember the quote as well as it were yesterday because I was sitting out in the audience. And if you had driven a 1929 Ford across this country every year between 1929 and the current 1961, what would you need? And the entire audience responded by saying, a new car. And Fox said, exactly, an Ocean Grove needs a new organ.
That was a turning point, but not a good one. Problems were remedied on the cheap and in ways better suited to a small room than a gargantuan auditorium. You never knew what would work, recalls the Philadelphia Orchestra's organist Michael Stairs. The core of the organ repertoire, J.S. Bach, was pretty much out of the question. Gordon Turk arrived in the mid-1970s and started undoing the damage. Valuable pipes were found discarded underneath the auditorium. Other like-minded instruments provided more pieces.
One set of pipes came from the Baptist Temple, which, of course, is the building from which Temple University evolved. And this was a set of pipes that was built by Hope Jones 3 years after he built this organ. And they were taking the organ out, and we were able to purchase the 32-foot diaphone pipes, which is a very low-pitched, fundamental, thunder-shaking stop.
Two years ago, Gordon Turk found another set of pipes that were once part of the Ocean Grove organ in a northern New Jersey garage. An organ enthusiast planned to build his own instrument but never got around to it. These pipes are back after a 40-year absence. Just this year, an antiphonal extension called an echo was installed in the rear of the auditorium. Even so, Turk says the organ is only two-thirds of what it was. That's hard to envision, but then the Ocean Grove organ arrived at a time of Victorian grandeur. Imagine a sonic counterpart to, Philadelphia City Hall, only tasteful. Others have compared it to a feast of comfort food. Yet the organ supplied little lasting comfort to Robert Hope Jones. Only a few years after his work in Ocean Grove, he suffered a decline not uncommon to great innovators of the early 20th century who couldn't function in competitive business. He might have had a stable, wealthy existence after joining forces with the organ manufacturing Wurlitzer brothers. But even in his best days, Hope Jones was described as an eccentric, and his personality clashed so much with theirs that he was marginalized by the company and sent away with a $50 a week pension. Indeed, Jones was notably absent from a 1914 anniversary gala of the Ocean Grove organ. Instead, he was found dead in a Rochester, New York rooming house. The cause was listed as suicide while insane. Lucky for us, the fruit of his more divine madness still lives and lives loud.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about the Ocean Grove Great Auditorium Pipe Organ in tomorrow's paper. The pipe organ is heard in recital by Gordon Turk at noon Saturdays and 7:30 in the evening on Wednesdays through July. The organ centennial will be further celebrated with a July 31st gala with full orchestra. And that's our program. Our thanks this week to Rona Gerber, Debbie Fleischman, and David Lotz. You can find an archive of previous shows and subscribe to our podcasts at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.